the Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.
Hi, and welcome to a Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast. Now, in this interview, we've got a repeat guest by the name of Barry Davis. Barry, welcome to the podcast once again.
Brilliant. Thanks for that, Dan. It's great to be on again.
My pleasure. The reason why I wanted to get Barry on again is that, as you may or may not know, Barry actually wrote a book that became an Amazon number one bestseller. And he's just written and just completed another book. So, Barry, welcome to the podcast. Why did you write a second book?
Well, things have changed a lot since my first book. So my first book details how I escaped the rat race. Well, actually, the story's not quite like that because I was actually sacked. So I was sacked before I had any money coming in from property. And in fact, I was making minus £50 a month from property. And I just needed to find a way to escape the rat race really, really quickly, or not to escape the rat race, but to replace my income. Yep. So the first book was all about that. It was all about lease options and the rent-to-rent strategy. But things have moved on for me since there. So whereas at the time when I had no money coming in, if I could make £500 a month out of a property, I thought it was brilliant, you know. Since then, things have changed a little bit and I've moved on to bigger and better deals. And I just wanted to share what I've learned because it's really, really timely. And because I know there are so many people out there that probably are just getting buy in property, and I'm sure as a coach yourself, Dan, you kind of see this all the time. People are just getting by, they're making 200 or 300 quid a month from each property deal that they do, and that's if nothing goes wrong. And I've really shifted on from that, from making 200 or 300 pounds profit a month. I'm now making kind of most of our deals make over £2,000 a month profit, and our best deal to date makes over £70,000 a year, so that's six grand a month in profit from our best deal.
Great. And so the example of this deal that brings in £70,000, I mean, how big a property is that? And how does a normal person, so I'm guessing that your book isn't aimed at the beginner, but someone, you know, the first book, Escape the Rat Race, is more geared for them. But this book is more geared for people who are maybe scraping by on £200 or 300 per month per deal, but actually want to upgrade to a £2,000 a month. But how big a deal is that? How many bedrooms? And just run through those sort of dynamics for me.
Yeah, so this deal's it's a 19-bedroom block of flats. So it's not massive. It's not kind of a skyscraper, but it's 19 bedrooms, and they're all en suite rooms. And that's made up of four HMO flats. So we've got 2 6-bed flats, 1 4-bed flat, and 1 3-bed flat. Now, each room is an en suite. Each room... The bigger rooms are almost big enough to be flats because we managed to pick up a really good building for a really good price. So it's not a massive deal. It's probably not out of the scope of a lot of your listeners, I guess. Anyone that's been doing a few of these deals will kind of realise that actually, you know, with a little bit more money and you know, being a bit more kind of creative about what you can do with a property, you can do deals like this. So we started looking at commercial properties, and this was a commercial property that used to be offices plus an ancillary cafe. We just kind of bought this property. We managed to get it for a lot better price because you can actually get commercial buildings for a lot cheaper than you could residential buildings.
Okay, and how did you finance this commercial building?
So this one we had to buy using a bridging loan. So the problem we had, and the problem I guess a few other people had, because this fell through twice before we bought it, and the price came down by about £100,000 because it fell through twice over about a year to 18 months. And the problem with financing this property was that high street banks just don't really want to lend on this. You know, this was an old, tired commercial property that needed work. So high street banks, generally, they just tend to want to lend on two up, two down houses, so they weren't interested. Commercial banks, on the other hand, they're more than happy. They don't mind the size of the property, you know, going up to millions and millions of pounds worth of property, as long as it's producing an income. Well, the owners were the occupiers of this property, so when they were selling it, it was going to cease producing any income, and it was tired and in need of work. so commercial lenders wouldn't lend either. Mm-hmm. So we had to take a bridging loan on this one. So the bridging company lent us, I think it was about 70%. So we got a bridging loan. It's very expensive. Cost us 1.5% a month with no entry fees, no exit fees, but still 18% a year is kind of an eye-watering rate.
And let me just clarify, how much did you buy the property for? Or is that a big secret that's in the book?
That's in the book. You can read it in the book. But also, I don't mind saying, we actually managed to pick up this property for $350,000. Okay. So this was very, very cheap for Bristol. The average three-bed house in or around the centre of Bristol is worth more than what we paid for this building. But still, it was still a big commitment, I suppose, because we're looking at paying, you know, £3,000 a month in bridging fees. And that's kind of eye-watering. That's more than most people would earn. But we did this because we realised the long-term potential. So we realised that this property could be making this £6,000. So I guess most people out there be a bit daunted by paying £3,000 a month in bridging fees. But if you can do that for a short time and then you have a property that makes you £6,000 a month for the rest of your life, I'd say it's well worth it. So so what we did, we took a bridging loan on this for the short term. And then once we got the planning permission, we were able to substitute this bridging loan with a development loan. So we actually use Lloyds for this. They gave us a development loan and it only cost us slightly more than what a normal mortgage was. So this was 6.5% per year that this was costing us. So that worked really, really well. And now we come to a position where we're just finishing off the project and, you know, we know what rents we can achieve in the area and we're going to be making over £6,000 a month.
Effectively then, you went for a bridge and then you went for a development loan and then the project's coming up to being completed now. Are you going to remortgage that?
Yes, definitely going to remortgage. So we've had a lot of cash tied up in this property, so we're going to remortgage now. Now, we've had an initial valuation of the property of £1.25 million. So even though, you know, we paid a lot for this property, the finance has cost us a lot of money and we spent a lot of money on the property, we're going to be able to refinance. We'll get all of the money that we invested in this property. We'll get all of that back. Plus, we're going to get another £150,000 on top. So effectively, we've been paid £150,000 to kind of buy a property that makes £6,000 a year. So
it's just worth mentioning that technically, you're not being paid that. You're actually being paid from a loan, effectively.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
It's just worth absolutely pointing that out for people on the call, so that you've not sold it. All you've done is you've remortgaged it for more than you purchased it for a lot more than you purchased it for. And now you don't have to take that £150,000 out, but if you want to buy a Ferrari or an Aston, I wouldn't recommend it, Barry. that's what I did with my 911. You know, you're buying a depreciating asset with money that's costing you money, so don't do that. I know you're going to, but don't. So ultimately, you're still paying interest on that £150,000, albeit at whatever interest rate you're going to get on that. But that's a phenomenal. So you bought £350,000 for the property. How much money have you actually spent on it, and how long did it take you to do the refurb?
The refurb, we had one builder that we needed to sack, so it took a little bit longer than we wanted. So the refurb actually went on for over a year. Well, not the work was being done for all of that time, but we had one builder, then we had to get rid of them. It took us a little while to get another builder online because it was such a big project. So it's been over a year doing that project. So the cost of that project, including the finance and everything else that we've needed to pay, because it's been over a year financing it, plus another few months whilst we were financing it. I think for 6 months the council took to give us planning permission, just because they said that they were short-staffed. So for 18 months we've been paying bridging loans on this thing. Our total spend is probably going to be about £350. So we're looking at £350 plus £350. So we've spent about £700,000 on this place, and it's now been valued at £1.25 million. So
I've got it. And where did you get the other £350,000 from in order to do that refurb?
So some of that was our money and some of that was from the development loan. So once we got the planning permission, the property was instantly worth an extra £100,000. So that made it easier to borrow against the property. And also the bank were happy to lend 66%, so two-thirds of the cost of developing the property. So then we've had to, I mean, obviously we've already got a very profitable portfolio and I've got a training and mentoring business. So we've had to kind of find various places to make up, you know, another 100 grand that we needed to put in.
So this is your biggest deal to date?
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, it's really, I just find it really interesting, and especially for people listening, their biggest deal may be like a 100 grand house or even a 50,000 pound house. It's, you know, it's a step-by-step process. Not everybody can go straight to a £1 million deal like this off straight from doing nothing. But it's a stepping stone from one to the other to the other. And every time you step onto that next stone, you're discovering how to actually do a deal like this. And what gave you the confidence to actually attack a deal like this, do you think?
I guess it was just that step-by-step thing. So I've always just wanted to do to make the next deal a little bit bigger than the last one. So I know a lot of people do this successfully, that they just keep sourcing properties. They can get them at a discount and they're two up, two downs. And they just systemize it and they just do it again and again and again. But that kind of thing doesn't really inspire me. And I've always wanted to make the next deal bigger than the last one. So we started off with kind of a house that I converted into two flats. Then I did another three-bed house. Then, you know, did a few of those that then get bored, then going up to five-bed houses. And what I realized as I was going up the chain was that these bigger deals were getting disproportionately better returns. So, for example, we might have a six-bedroom HMO and it makes us £1,000 a month. Well, if we can find a way to make that six-bed HMO or another property into an eight-bedroom HMO, we'd get an extra £1,100 to £1,200 in rent coming in. So we're getting £550, maybe even £600 for an ensuite now in Bristol. So if we can have an eight-bed rather than a six-bed, we'd actually be making £2,000 a month profit instead of £1,000 a month profit.
Yeah,
just with two extra rooms, we've doubled our profit. And we've just realised if we can do this, rather than having to buy a lot of houses that make, you know, 500 quid or a grand each, if we can do deals that make an average of about £2,000 a month, we just need to do a lot less of these deals to get the kind of impact that we want on our cash flow.
And interestingly, I'm guessing as well, at these size of deals, the competition is much lower. There's not many other people that are chasing after these deals.
Yeah, exactly right. So there's so many people with first-time buyers now. A lot of investors looking at the same properties as well. So you've got two up, two down houses. All of the first-time buyers, plus the majority of investors, are looking at these small properties. And it's just absolutely saturated. I mean, we looked at a property recently that we could have made a HMO out of. It was on the market for £330, and we felt that we could just about make this work as a HMO at that price. I phoned up the agent after it had been on for less than a week. They had had 19 viewings, they'd had 9 offers, and the highest offer at the time was £20,000 above the asking price.
And what was the asking price again?
This was £330. So before they'd even got to kind of a sealed bids process, they had bids on the table of £350,000.
Wow.
So, I mean, Bristol's very, you know, very busy market, you know, a lot of owner-occupiers and investors looking. And so in the normal marketplace, it can be tricky to find good deals. When you start looking at bigger deals like this, you know, something that you're going to have to get a bridging loan on that's going to cost you £3,000 a month, or you're going to have to buy it for cash and invest, you know, £250,000, a lot less people are looking at doing those deals, and that's where you can get such better deals. You know, so we were able to get a 19-bedroom property, 19 big double bedrooms, all with en suites, and we were able to pick up that for the same price as what a three-bed house would have cost us.
Amazing. So let me ask you about planning permission then, because one of the big concerns a lot of investors have, so it's like things like, I don't know, maybe B&Bs or pubs. They're obviously ripe for multi-lets or houses multiple occupation, but what about worrying about planning? How did you get through planning, and what were your worries about that?
Yeah, so that was one of our biggest worries. So probably the best thing you can do with risk is to eliminate it. So the way that it would have been potentially possible to eliminate this risk was to make an offer subject to planning permission. So this property was on the market for offers in excess of 360. We offered 350 for it, subject to getting planning for it. The sellers came back and said, look, if we wanted to make them wait around whilst we got planning permission, then they wouldn't accept less than 400,000. So then we went back to the drawing board. 400,000 would still have been a good price if we got the planning we wanted, but we started looking at our other options. So our most desired outcome was to create a series of four HMOs. Looking at the floor plan, we realised that this would give us the most cash flow. The problem was that this was in an Article 4 area. So if you are converting properties into shared housing, you need to get planning permission for this. We weren't sure if we'd get that, but that was our plan A. We thought, really, we need a plan B. So our plan B was that under permitted development, we could turn this commercial property, which was offices, into residential property through the permitted development route. So you don't need to go through the full planning. And the council shouldn't really be able to stop you doing this because the government have brought in legislation to get the economy going, to get more homes to be produced. Yeah. So through this permitted development route, we would have been able to make this property into kind of one and two bedroom flats without needing to go through the full planning. And the council shouldn't really have been able to stop us doing that. And the good thing about this plan B was that the property would actually have been worth significantly more as one and two bedroom flats. Now, I'm always investing for cash flow. As one and two bedroom flats, this property would have made about £1,800 a month less. So, you know, that's over 20 grand a year less that it would have made us. But as a plan B, it would have been a property that would have been worth over £1.5 million when it was done. And would have been a deal where, you know, again, we'd be able to refinance it. We would have created over £500,000 of equity, just like we have with our plan A. I was still a little bit uncomfortable with this because, you know, it's a lot of money. We were taking a big risk, or there was potentially a big risk because we were paying out £3,000 a month for this property. So I kind of wanted a plan C as well. So my plan C was to think, how could we do something with this building where we need no planning permission whatsoever? And I looked at it as an office block, and I looked at the price at £350,000, and I thought, well, you know, actually, if we were just to refurbish this property, bring it up to a good standard, we could easily rent this as offices and turn a relatively good profit. Like, this wasn't our most desired outcome, it's not what we do. But as a backup plan, you know, we know that we could have made a profit from this property. So that's kind of how we dealt with the risk. We weren't really able to get it subject to planning unless we wanted to pay an extra £50,000. And knowing that we had this plan A, this plan B and this plan C, we decided to take the risk on planning our side, get the property for £50,000 less, and apply for the planning permission, knowing that we had two backup options as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And just explain the permitted development. So this allows you to convert offices into homes, but there are limits as to what you can do, obviously. Just explain what that is.
Yeah, so you're allowed to convert offices, so B1 class, and that's a planning use class. So B1 offices can be converted into a C3 residential property, which is just kind of a standard residential property that's not shared housing or anything like that. So a lot of developers are out there using this at the moment, a lot more in London, turning big office blocks into residential property. Now, the council shouldn't really be able to stop you doing this. They can kind of have objections down to, you know, whether there's not enough access for cars and things like that. But generally, they don't. A number of councils have had their wrists slapped when yeah. they've tried to actually stop developers from doing this, because the government have brought this in for a reason, and they want councils to follow suit. So basically, you can go from B1 offices to C3 residential without planning. Now, that's currently only in place until May 2016. A lot of people are saying that will be extended, but certainly we don't really know that at the moment.
I just want to go back to planning again, because specifically, people are out there and they're looking at deals, and it may be an enormous house, or more typically things like pubs or existing offices. What would be the path for somebody who's seen a place, it may be commercial, and actually wants to go put an offer in on it and get planning? What would you advise to be the best plan there? Is it having A, B and C plans just in case? What's the best way for them to do it with the least risk, do you think?
The best way with the least risk is always going to be to be able to put an offer forward subject to getting planning permission. Because, you know, then you don't end up with, a red herring, a property that you can't really do anything with, or that's just going to be a thorn in your side. So if ever you can do something subject to planning, that's the best way to do it. Now, a lot of developers use this, all of the massive sites like, Wimpy and all of those companies, they're all buying plots subject to planning permission. So it's very, very common with commercial property. So it's not going to be something that the owners of the property maybe haven't heard before. Okay. That's definitely the best way. And I suppose a couple of other things. Yeah, always try and have a plan A, a plan B and a plan C. Ideally, having one of your backup plans as something that doesn't involve getting any planning permission, that's all, you're always onto a winner, because then the council can't really stop you doing it if it doesn't involve needing to get planning permission.
Got it.
I'd also really recommend getting experts in. So we got a planning consultant in to help us do this, and we're able to kind of show that, this is a bit of a rundown street. The offices, were not really needed. Part of the building was a cafe, and we're able to demonstrate that this was kind of on a bit of a side street and wasn't really a viable business. But we got a professional to put this all into the right language, because I can kind of blabber on how this wouldn't have been the best use for this building, and what we were going to do was going to really regenerate the area. But unless you know the planning speak and you kind of know the planning policies and you can go through all of that, just best to really get a professional.
You know, the number one top tip that I've got so far from this is actually to go out, find loads of buildings that are not doing that much, that look run down, and just go put lots of offers in on them, subject to planning.
Yeah, definitely, because you've got nothing to lose. It costs you nothing to put an offer forward. And then obviously you only go forward, only some people will accept the offers. But then you can do it at very low risk. So the only risk to you would be probably the cost of planning and getting that, the cost of the solicitor to draw up a contract. And it's really important to draw up the contract. And what else? You may have to pay, what you'd usually do this with an option contract. Now, you may have to pay an option fee to get someone to do this. But that's going to be a few thousand rather than kind of, hundreds of thousands that you might spend on the building.
Yeah, okay. And what are the other worries I think that people have? We've got all these old sayings like don't put all your eggs in one basket, for example. And so we have sayings like that. And so people think, oh, I better not put all my eggs in one basket because that's when things may go wrong. But actually, in this particular deal, you have all your eggs in this one basket. And yet, that's the sort of, this old school language that actually stops people moving on. In my experience, all these old school sayings are actually complete rubbish, and you should just ignore them. Because we don't live in the old school. We're in the 21st century. We just found water on Mars that flows. We're in a modern world. We've actually populated a planet with robots. Believe it or not, and it's called Mars, because we sent 3 or 4 robotic devices there, which, is the stuff of science fiction in the 1950s. So a lot of these old sayings are really designed to stop you from moving forward, like money is the root of all evil. Well, it's not, is it? Actually, money is the root of quite a lot of happiness. If you're constantly unhappy, then money's not going to help, but having more money definitely helps your happiness. I know that because I can go out on a jet ski this afternoon if I chose to, for example, because money has allowed me to do that. But a lot of these old school sayings. So how did you feel about putting all your eggs in one basket in this particular deal? And were you worried about not being able to rent rooms out?
This is what we spent years kind of developing. We've been renting out rooms, and we really just specialised. So rather than a lot of people would say diversify by some of these properties, some of that. Mm-hmm. And what actually happens is you end up being mediocre at a lot of things, whereas if you can specialize and really focus and really get really good at your core business, then there's a lot of risk. So Warren Buffett, one of his quotes that's in my book, says risk comes from not knowing what you're doing. So if you're trying to not put all of your eggs in one basket, if you're trying to use lots of different methods and do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, you're just not going to be able to really hone your skills and really kind of learn what to do. So we covered a lot of our risk, but we did put a lot into this property. So we did kind of invest a lot of money. We did chuck a load in to buy the place and to do it up. And it was costing us a fortune every month in bridging finance. But because we knew our market so well, you know, because we've got over 100 rooms already, we really know the market. And so it doesn't feel like a risk. So we just rented out our most expensive room yesterday so far, and we're getting £700 a month for that room. Now, I know a lot of houses in other cities that rent for a lot less than that. So we're getting £700 for just one room. And this new property is going to be better than anything we've done before. So all of our figures, we're always fairly pessimistic. Our figures are based on getting kind of 600 or 650 a room. And now I'm thinking we're probably going to be able to push this property up to 700 or even more pounds per room. And we've got 19 large ensuite rooms there. So the figure that we're talking about, the £6,000 a year, I mean, it could very well go up from that. And we'll find out in a couple of weeks.
Okay. £6,000 a month.
£6,000 a month, yeah, 70-something grand a year. No, not £6,000 a year, that's like most people's deals.
So let me ask you another question then. What do you need to do? I mean, I can imagine a Donald Trump penthouse, you know, with loads of gold. How do you get £700 per room, and what do you need to put in that room? Is it gold-plated taps and a gold-plated bath and a gold-plated bed? And is it that gaudy sort of Donald Trump stuff? Or what is it that separates that room from all the other rooms that may be rented at £400?
So firstly, on that room, we've got a really good location for that one. So that almost cannot always be helped. But I always recommend people buy things in the best location. So that property overlooks the waterfront in Bristol. So you've got a room that's 4.5 metres by 5.5 metres, plus an ensuite. So ensuites always tend to rent out for about £100 more than double rooms. So straight away, to maximise the rent, we put ensuites in. The furniture then is it's IKEA. It's not the cheapest IKEA. It's kind of mid-range IKEA stuff. We just find that we'll always be able to replace the furniture because IKEA don't really change their ranges that much. And then a lot of the other things is we do things like we're putting sofas into the room. So on the large rooms, we put sofas in, we put coffee tables in, and it feels a lot more like a flat than a room. And it's not that we're really cramming the things in. We've got enough space that we can actually have dividing up the rooms to one area where you can kind of sit, sit on the sofa, you've got a coffee table, have your dinner there if you wish. And then we've got another area of the room, which is kind of the bed and the bedroom and the wardrobe and things like that. So large rooms can help to maximise the rents, but it's also then taking that basics. And we used to stop just there, you know. So we used to stop when, you know, we put maybe a sofa in, we put a wardrobe, a chest of drawers, a desk, a bed. We'd put those in and we just leave it at that and think, well, you know, surely people have got imagination. If they want to make this room nice, then they can do that. Learned from a few other people recently, because I'm always learning, just about working out how to maximise the rents by just a little finishing touches. Now, some of these things, like bedside lamps, they might cost you £10 for a bedside lamp, but if it feels really nice when someone comes through the door, then it's really, really worth it. And people want to then live there because it's kind of feels quite homely. So things like bedside lamps, throws across the bed, candles, all of that kind of stuff really make a place feel like a home rather than just kind of a house share. Because 95% of the properties out there are just bland. You know, every wall is magnolia. There's no colours within the room. Quite often, you know, when a lot of people do view-ins, they'd have the really cheap box beds there that with kind of a tartan pattern on, you know, the kind of really cheap landlordy things. And they just look so uninspiring. So if 95% of the market are doing that, But you, if someone comes into your place, it looks like a home. It looks like someone could just literally just move in with a suitcase, and it just looks absolutely lovely and homely. It's easy to get kind of 20, even 30% more rent over someone that's just done things to a basic standard.
Yeah, got it. Okay. And in this particular property, how many boilers have you got? Is it more than one? And if it is just one, how big is it?
No, we've got a range of boilers, and one of the reasons for that was because there aren't that many people in the market for a £1.25 million building, even if it's producing a really good return. There are just not that many people in the market. And I felt just having this one big 19-bedroom HMO, it would really limit the value of that because, you know, when you've got such a small market or such a small amount of buyers wanting to buy the place, they're going to be able to kind of name their price. Now, there are a lot more people that would invest in, say, a £350 six-bed flat, and that's why we've gone to that model. So we've put a boiler in each room. We've got separate electric, water, gas. So each of these flats within this building is a completely self-contained unit and could be sold off individually.
Got it.
And because there are so many more people looking for a £350,000 building, because you'd need to invest maybe £100,000 deposit and, you know, and things into a place like that, rather than needing to invest maybe £500,000 in one of the, you know, in the whole block. So that's why we did that. We split that down. So we've got a boiler in each room. In each flat, and we've got relatively big tanks there to make sure that everyone will always have hot water.
Got it. Perfect. And how many kitchens are in this block?
Four kitchens in this block. So, we've got 2 6-bed flats, 1 4-bed flat, and 1 3-bed flat. Probably 6 is probably a good enough number because people have got their sofas in their rooms, they've got coffee tables in their rooms. So they can kind of choose to socialise, or they can kind of choose to have like their own time in their room, if you see what I mean. So some people think, well, I wouldn't want to live with 5, 6, or 7 other people. But if you can kind of give them their own space and their own sofa, as well as the communal room, and we always put communal rooms and kitchens in.
And what goes in a communal room?
So communal room, we usually have a table and chairs, not necessarily always for 6 people, but, you know, we have a 4 people table and chairs. We'd have then we'd have sofas, so maybe like a big corner sofa, and you've only really got half the people in at once. So if you can have, you know, even if everyone was in that room and you had some of the people sat at the table and some of the people on the sofa, they've just got more than enough space. But generally, the communal spaces at most seem to be about half full, you know, with the people, because everyone's kind of doing their own thing and living their own life.
And in terms of keeping the kitchen clean, once this development's totally finished, do you put cleaners in like once a month, once every 2 weeks? What do you do about that?
Yeah, so we have cleaners in every 2 weeks. So we're finding that works at the moment. That tends to be good. We still get some houses that are tidier than others. I think it's just human nature that, you know, everyone's different. So some of the houses we think, well, we don't even really need these cleaners because all of the tenants are keeping it spotless anyway. Yeah. And other houses, you know, tend to be a little bit more messy. Something we're working on at the moment, trying to find out what it is to keep the house tidy.
In my HMOs and multilets, what I do is I have a document. I'm pretty sure you might do the same, actually. But I've got a tenant's handbook that we give to them when they move in, and it explains to them what the rules are, what the rules aren't, what they should do to be a good tenant and a good neighbour. And we get them to sign it as well. And when they sign it, it's not a contract or anything like that. You know, we've got the tenancy agreement and that's separate, but we get them to sign like a piece of paper to say that they've received it. And what we found was when we didn't get them to sign it, we'd have more mess. And then as soon as we got people to sign it, the less was far less. And it was just that simple act of getting someone to actually sign a piece of paper makes it more official and contractual.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's everything psychological, isn't it? So whether that contract's ever going to stand up in court, and I'm sure it's not.
It won't. But, we don't do it for that. We do it to get that psychological agreement from the tenant.
Psychologically, they kind of put their name to it, you know, so people then have ownership.
So after this deal, what's next? is it Buckingham Palace? You're going to knock that through, put 38 rooms in there. What's next?
Well, we've actually got more than enough money coming in at the moment. And to be honest, what's always kind of taken the back burner is like having a nice place to live. So recently we started looking up absolutely stunning properties around Bristol. Once we've completed this deal, we refinance it and we get all of the, you know, we get the money back that we invested plus this money. We're going to have like £500,000 for a deposit for a house.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Probably the next deal for us is probably going to be like a beautiful home. Really like nice old buildings with massive rooms. And so we're looking for something like that. And I do my mentoring. I'm hoping to do my mentoring from home now with small groups of people. And we've seen a beautiful mansion just outside of Bristol. So, fingers crossed, it's very early days, but to have the builders round and things like that. So next for us is probably a big home.
Yep.
My wife is 4 months pregnant nearly. So in 5 months time, or 5 or 6 months time, we'll have a little one running around, or not running around quite. It's not straight away, but, so that's
congratulations. That's awesome.
That's very different. I suppose next for us is probably we need more people really. So we've always done things. We've always got the experts in when necessary, but we haven't had like loads and loads of employees. We've always kept things fairly tight. But we need to get some more people in now to help us grow. So that's probably the next step for us. And we found with this most recent builders that we got in, they've made it very, very easy, a very, very easy process. So if we can get the right builders, we can actually take a bit more of a back seat, you know, go and visit the sites maybe 2 or 3 times a week. But really, using the right people, they're just taking all of the hassle away. So we just need to build a team of a lot better people. We'll still be doing these bigger deals. We'll probably be looking at doing, you know, just do 2 or 3 deals a year, maybe a couple of, you know, 8 to 10 bed HMOs and then one big deal like this. Probably look to make the next deal maybe, you know, 30, 40 beds. And then if you're dividing these into flats, there's no reason why you can't have a place with, you know, 50 to 100 beds in, because people don't feel like they're living in a 100 bedroom HMO. They're actually living in a 5-bed flat or something like that. So
yeah,
definitely moving forward, I think more and more people are going to be living in HMOs and properties like this. We're always doing our properties at the top end, so I'm always very convinced that they'll be full. When you're in the top 5% of properties out there, you can always guarantee that you'll be full. So even if the ask completely falls out of the market, your rents that you achieve would go down, but you'll always be full.
Were you also talking about the population getting older now as well? First-time buyers obviously are getting older and older and older. It's up to like nearly 40 now, I think it is. And so you've got people who are like 37 and they're having to live on their own. They're not in a relationship, or they were and now they're not, or they're divorced and separated and so on. And so the population is definitely ageing, and I think this is a good opportunity to provide accommodation for that specific population. How old are you now, Barry?
I'm 34 now.
34, okay. And how many years have you been in property?
I've been in property for... I bought a house to turn into a couple of flats. That was back in 2007. So now we're 2015, so
8 years. So you've gone from minus £50,
yeah,
to potentially £500,000 as a deposit on your next house,
yeah,
in just 8 years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we've got
phenomenal.
Yeah, so I mean, we didn't ever think we'd be able to buy a mansion, and potentially we're not even going to have to, because we thought about selling a couple of properties too. But you know, looking at it now, we might not even have to sell any houses and go and buy a mansion. So that's pretty crazy.
I just want to pick you up on something else that you mentioned, and it's that you buy for cash flow. Now, I know people who buy for what they call capital growth, and they're constantly rattling on about capital growth. And my strategy is similar to yours in that I've always bought for cash flow, because capital growth will happen all on its own because the market will just send it up. But if you're just investing for capital growth, you might as well put like £20,000 on red. It's black or red, you know, the roulette table, because no one really has a clue. people think they have a clue, but no one really knows about capital growth. So I think I love how you invest the cash flow, because at the end of each month, if you're running out of money, you just hold your breath for a couple of days, and then you're into the next month, and all the money comes back in. And investing for cash flow is the correct way for property investors to invest, in my opinion. And it sounds like you've gone down that same path as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's not just that, it's just so risky. Having small margins in any business is just so, so risky. Mm. So if you've got all of these houses that, as long as everything goes well, you've invested for cash flow, so if you've invested just for capital growth and you're making a couple of hundred quid per property, now, when you start having a few boilers go wrong, it could just put you into loads and loads of trouble, or if you have some tenants that aren't paying. And a lot of people have kind of focused on buying these properties. They almost don't really care about the kind of the properties or the tenants. And so these kind of people can have like boilers and things go wrong like we all can. But also, if these people aren't really focused on running this as a proper business and they're just speculating and just buying houses because they think they'll go up, it's very, very risky. Because if they're not looking after the tenants and they're, they're just buying these houses and leaving them sit there, they're going to end up with kind of tenants not paying. They're going to end up with tenants doing a runner. So it's really, really important to kind of do it as a proper business, to set it up really properly. And we're making now, our best rooms are making over £300 profit per month. So it's not 300 yeah. rent. I mean, that's what the profit is. And we used to make that on a whole house.
Yeah.
It's just so much less risk to be running at a margin. So our margin at the moment is about 40%. So for every 10 grand of rent we get in, 4,000 of that is profit. Now, I know for a lot of people out there, for every 10 grand of rent that they get in, there may only be kind of £500 to £1,000 profit there.
Yeah.
And that's just very, very risky.
Absolutely. So what's the book called?
So the book is called Retire on One Deal. It's not just about that deal. It's not really just about the deal that makes 70 grand a year, but it's just about how people should be thinking bigger and looking at larger properties and larger HMOs. The reason I wrote the book was because I know there are so many people out there that are making 200 or 300 quids quids profit out of each property, and a lot of people just getting buying property. You know, maybe if they've got a few properties, they're making up to £1,000 a month. But it's not exactly what most people signed up for. Most people kind of got into property as a way of getting some freedom. And when you're making just a small amounts on property, it's just not going to give you that freedom. When you're making small margins, you can't really employ the staff to free yourself up. And so I wrote the book to take people from making £200 or £300 per property per month to be making an average of maybe £2,000 or £3,000 per property per month. And then also looking at even bigger deals that would make a real, real difference, you know, something that might make £6,000 a month.
So, okay. And is this available on Kindle or in print or both?
This is available. It's already on Kindle. This is also going to be available in print in just a couple of days. I'm just getting the books printed as we speak.
Okay.
But for your listeners, Dan, we said we'd do an offer for you because you really want to give your listeners good value. So if your listeners want to download this book, I'm happy to give them a free copy of this book. So they just need to, if they can text HMO to the short text code, so just text HMO to 66777, text their name and their email address, then I can get them a book sent out via email.
We fully expect this book to go to number one on Amazon in the next couple of, I was going to say a couple of weeks, but actually by next week, I think it'll be number one anyway.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful. I love the fact that you're giving the book away free of charge. I didn't expect that actually, Barry, so thank you very much. And if they want to contact you specifically, Barry, what would be the best way for people to contact you? I know you do coaching and you offer mentorship to help people who are not brand new at this, but people have been in the game for a little bit and done a few deals. What's the best way for them to contact you?
Well, as soon as they sent that out for us, we'll be sending them an email, and then we'll be in contact with these guys.
Perfect. Right then, Barry, that's wonderful. Thank you very much for sharing all that information. What I love about doing podcasts is people can listen to a podcast, get inspired, and then go out and start start putting in lots of offers for objective planning on like lots and lots of things. And by tomorrow afternoon, people are like, oh my God, I've got my first deal.
Yeah.
And and literally that's how it works, you know. Even those that take imperfect action and get it completely wrong are far more successful than those that wait for perfect action and get it everything just right before they take action. Those guys tend not to do very well. But the other ones who haven't got a clue but just go out and do it, I mean, the more of a clue you have, the better it is. That's why you should like buy Barry's book and get the book for free. But just taking that imperfect action and getting out there and putting in offers subject to planning, I love that. So thank you very much, Barry. And I'm pretty sure in a couple of months' time when you do your next book, or maybe next year, we'll get you straight back on the podcast and talk to us more about that. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Nice one. Thanks a lot, Dan.
The Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.